Hi, this is Sean Levy. I'm the director of Cheaper by the Dozen. And as long as we're starting with the Fox logo, I'll start with the Fox story, because this was a project that was brought to me by Hutch Parker, the president of production at Fox. I just shown Just Married to the studio, which was my prior film, and they were pleased with that one. And Hutch said, I think I have your next movie, and he brought me Cheaper by the Dozen. And this was a project that Hutch had been developing for close to a decade, and he really saw the movie that it could be, a movie that was big and funny and really touching. And he was determined to make me see what this could be, and he just hammered on me with admirable determination, and as did Tom Rothman and then Vanessa Morrison, the VP, and they finally convinced me to take on this rather daunting task of making a big, sweeping movie about a large family. And I'm glad they stuck with it, and I'm glad they didn't give up, because of everything I've done thus far, I'm most proud of this. And indeed, the movie is what they thought it could be. It's big and touching and true and funny and just kind of about the small and big things that we all deal with in families, in life.
It's the number of times we zero.
And the first move was Steve Martin. If you can get Steve Martin to anchor your family comedy, you get Steve Martin to anchor your family comedy. And this was actually, Tom Rothman was fierce in his determination to get Steve. And I am so indebted to that, for that vision, because Steve is one of those few actors who can be, you know, both heartwarming and funny and kind of honest at both. So once we had Steve on board, we had to go find our Kate Baker. And as soon as we sat down with Bonnie Hunt, we knew that we'd found our person. Bonnie is one of the great, quick, sharp comedic minds around. And when she and Steve sat down over lunch, the level and speed of banter was so far over my head that I knew I was in good shape. I mean, they were just zinging it back and forth, and they're both so smart and so funny that I knew they'd be a phenomenal couple at the heart of this movie. This moment that's coming up here, when the kids explode from under the sheets, I love this moment. I love not only the visuals, I love the way the 10,000 Maniac song, These Are Days, rises in volume, and it's just this pure, visceral, feel-good moment that sets the tone for the movie that I wanted to make, which was a movie that was chaotic and loud and messy and funny and touching. And this is kind of a microcosm of that blended tone that I was going for. We now go into the flashback sequence, and I love the kind of simulation of different film media here. We go into this flashback, and I wasn't sure we needed the flashback. I worried, frankly, about digressing into flashbacks so early in the movie. But a lot of people convinced me, rightfully, that the audience wants to know how this family came about, and this is where we tell. That guy there with the mustache and the fro, that's Gene Repke, my assistant for the last 3 years. 3 years, three movies. Gene, who I affectionately call my giant, has been my assistant, and who knew that his cameo as the scary-looking 70s dude would end up being immortalized forever in this film. Here we have the behind-the-pillar time-lapse trick. Not particularly high-tech, but, you know, it accomplishes the task. Jonathan Brown, whose credit is on screen, Jonathan Brown has shot all three of my movies. Big Fat Liar, Just Married, and Cheaper by the Dozen. He's awesome, and the quality of his work has gone up steadily with every collaboration. And he's just kind of one of those core members of my team who I love having him in the trench. You know, making a movie is hard. It's intense. It's challenging. And you want people around you who are willing to do whatever is needed to get the job done. And Johnny B., Jonathan Brown, is my boy, and he's been at my side my whole career as a film director, and frankly, he's, you know, helped me have a career and helped me build a career, so loyal to him forever.
We were happy, and we were done.
Various writing credits coming up here. Every one of these writers played a hand. I only got a chance to work personally with Sam Harper, who wrote Just Married, and who really did all of the defining late drafts of this script. And he's just a great guy and a great writer and really good at capturing blended tone, which is to say funny and occasionally broadly funny, but never at the cost of heart. And that was really the motto on this movie. Here we kind of are introduced to the bedlam that is the Baker life. And, you know, this was an example of coordinating 6-7 actors, many of whom are kids. This shot here, Hilary Duff in the bathroom, that's a reshoot. That's actually an additional shot that we grabbed many, many months after we shot the movie, because Hilary wasn't available when we shot this scene in the hallway, and her line played off camera. But watching the movie, I knew that it would be that much better if we could meet Hilary, meet Lorraine on camera early, because it'll integrate her into the family in a way that an off-camera line couldn't. Here we have a really charming scene between Steve Martin and Tom Welling. This is Tom Welling's first movie. Tom is known to millions of fans as, you know, Clark Kent, Superman on the WB series Smallville, and yet he'd never done a movie. And when I met with Tom, you know, he was being offered bigger parts and bigger movies, starring roles, and I said to him, look, you can do all those parts, and I'm sure you'll do great, but if you want to be an actor and you want to be, you know, challenged and respected as one actor among a core ensemble of actors, come and do my film. And he responded to that, because really Tom wanted to do the work, and he gets plenty of adulation everywhere else in his life, that this was really about coming to work and being treated as one of a group. And there was no attitude, and I'll say the same thing for Hilary Duff and all the celebrities in this movie. They really responded to the ensemble vibe on set. Here we have Shane and Brent Kinsman. That was not planned. I told them to feed the dog. This whole idea of dumping the entire bag of dog food, they came up with themselves. And it's fantastic. These kids are going by so fast, I'll try and hit all of them. But I want to comment for a moment on the song playing in this scene. It's People Come Together by Len. And this was a song that was given to me by Dave Jordan, my music supervisor, who worked on Big Fat Liar. And he gave me this song, People Come Together, when I was shooting the movie. And I thought it was a great kind of intuitive read of the tone of the movie, because it's thematically on point. It's a sample of an old song, but it's remixed in a fresh and contemporary way. And that's really the challenge in this movie, both musically and directorially, is this is a movie for parents, grandparents, teens, and kids. And how do you appeal to all those bandwidths, if you will, without being condescending to any single demographic? So the movie, you know, I'm aware it vacillates wildly between, you know, demographic appeals. And frankly, that's the point.
Mike, you have show and tell today. Please, honey, remember that body parts do not count. Kyle and Nigel, you have a dentist appointment.
A lot of this stuff that Bonnie does is scripted. But frankly, a lot of it is not scripted. And I have to just, you know, Bonnie is a committed improv actor. She wants to mix it up. She wants to give you options in the cutting room. And her process is very, very different than Steve Martin. Steve is obviously equally brilliant, but much more, you know, prepared, and kind of he plans what he's going to do. And he'll mix it up in rehearsal, but by the time we shoot, he wants to know what's going to happen. And that's his process. Whereas Bonnie doesn't want to know what's going to happen. And in fact, she doesn't want you to know what's going to happen. So it made for a really interesting challenge as far as acting styles and comedic styles, because Bonnie throws out a lot of ideas, a lot of ad-libs, and frankly, they are like, you know, they're like presents, they're like gifts, because almost every hilarious line of Kate Baker, Bonnie came up with personally, and I'm grateful to her forever for constantly challenging the script and pushing it. Here we have the classic egg frog chaos scene. We like had a jet engine rigged by our effects department led by Dave Kelsey inside that bowl of eggs. And this scene, for reasons that now escape me, I wanted to shoot it on location in Petaluma at this house. You know, rule number one, if you have a big set piece, you shoot it on stage where you can control things and remove walls and have the space. I don't know what the heck I was thinking, but we shot this in a real farmhouse up in Petaluma. It took us 2 to 3 days, and it was as chaotic and messy and smelly as it looks. What can I say? In the long run, I'm grateful for it, because the scene has a kind of contained chaos that works, but it was really hard to shoot, and a lot of us got really nauseous from the smell of rotting scrambled eggs. I love this shot here, kind of the family cheering. I always viewed the mass of kids as like a Greek chorus in this scene. Here we have small little ADR elements, like you have one kid off camera saying, busted. You know, I love stuff like that. And if you listen to the movie without my yammering, you'll hear a lot of background, kind of unnecessary ADR elements that just make the texture of the movie and the soundscape of the movie that much fuller. And I'm really grateful to Andrew DeCristofaro and the entire team at Soundstorm. My sound team was exceptional because they recognized that the conventional wisdom is that action films are really complicated sound and family films are easy. Let me tell you something. You got a movie with 14 characters, it's an action movie. And the Soundstorm team recognized that and built a really dense layered soundscape. This sky, by the way, is fake. There's a lot of sky replacements in this movie just because I wanted to create a Midland. And frankly, I wanted to create a family life that was idyllic and utopian. And you know, what I realized is kind of, it was raining while we were filming this scene. So you've got this idyllic utopian blue sky, but as you can see, the lighting is gray and we had the actors covered with tarps. And look, this was not some massive budget movie. This was a reasonably kind of mid-range budget movie. And I didn't have the luxury, as some kind of larger budget movies do, of saying, okay, it's raining, we're not going to shoot. We shot Rain or Shine. And my crew really helped control the elements the extent that we could.
All right.
Again, Shane and Brent Kinsman, these guys had never done a movie. They'd never done a TV show. And as was the case with many of the kids, I cast them because there was something fresh and non-kiddy actor about them. They were just, you know, they're real kids. And so what you had was an often uncontrolled shooting experience. You know, the benefit is that it's always honest and you're kind of capturing nuggets of unplanned performance.
Honey, she's just trying to have her own life.
She's too young to have her own life.
She's 22, the same age I was when I was pregnant with her.
5 minutes ago, she was sitting on my shoulders pointing at cows in Munger's field.
This is classic Steve Martin coming up. I love this exchange, which Sam Harper and I came up with when we were polishing up the script. The idea that a wife was checking out her husband of 22 years. Because, look, this is a movie about marriage as much as it's a movie about family. And we all know that kind of there are challenges in that. And I love that this family keeps their sense of humor. This marriage and this couple keeps their sense of humor. I had several songs for this spot, and like one after another, the songs that I loved were unclearable. Not because they were too expensive, but because, you know, there were just too many artists involved. So here we are kind of beginning to sell the idea of Tom Baker as a football coach. Now, obviously, Steve Martin is not a football player, so we rewrote the script with the idea that he was a third-string receiver who never got his shot. And that coaching, that, you know, he may not have been the quickest or the toughest player, but he was the smartest. So the creation of this world, this football world, we don't do much of it, but it's important, you know, that it feel real to the extent that we do put it in the movie. Great actor coming up here, Richard Jenkins, who is inexplicably lurking behind the wall. I've always felt that I really staged that a little poorly because I don't know where he's coming from.
Hey, what are you doing here?
What, are you still too busy?
Coming up, this newspaper. This is a picture of Marty Schwartz, my first AD for the last two films. Great AD, great guy to have on my team, and just fun to be around also. This scene with the twins, with Shane and Brent, this took a long time. This was an example where literally I sent the adult actors away, and it was me and the five-year-olds. And we went sentence by sentence, 20, 30 times per sentence if necessary, until I got the exact reading I wanted. And ultimately, you know, with some phenomenal editing by my fantastic editor, George Folsey. You know, their performance is great, and the twins are you know, one of the best parts of the movie, and always a crowd pleasing element.
Got all this. So you're gonna tell me why you're here?
Lincoln's a winning machine.
Coming up here, we have a kind of small behavior thing. When Richard Jenkins says coach, I had him do kind of the sideways gun gesture, like Shake McGuire's, like a wannabe gangster or something. I thought that was obnoxious and funny to me, at least. This like many of the sets, is a location created by Nina Ruscio. Nina has been my production designer on all of my movies. She is my rock, and no matter what I ask for, she finds a way to deliver. And what I love about this scene and a lot of the production design in this movie is the texture of real life. It's small details of set decoration or the patina on that pillar, for instance, or the way that the paint has been treated that feels aged and kind of lived in and worn away. Or look in the background here, the way each kid has their little milk crate cubby of laundry. It's these small things that Nina does, as well as the big things. But she's a hell of a production designer, and it's why she's always at my side.
Midland has been great for raising our kids, but
you know, this scene here, we played with this. There was a version of this scene where it was about the joke. It was about the upside-down kid. And what we ultimately did is we literally restructured the scene so that the kid became background, a kind of uncommented-on background joke. And the focus is on what matters, which is Bonnie and Steve talking about uprooting their family and having a real conversation about that.
Okay, everybody, you know the drill.
This scene here, we shot it again on location up in Petaluma, and I really like the scene. I think Sam Harper wrote it really, really well. And just kind of this is where you get a sense of how there's kind of overlaps and a chaotic energy and rhythm to a family this big, which is a big part of the film. There's so many kids, and I'll try and mention them over the course of the movie. I'll just start with, let's start with the next shot with Tom Welling and Allison Stoner. I've spoken a bit about Tom. Allison Stoner, who plays the awesome smart aleck there on the right, Sarah Baker, she is kind of semi-famous already because she is the dancer in Missy Elliott's music videos, and that's where I first saw her. And she's just this certainly a fantastic dancer, but also a great little actress and totally captured the kind of likable snarkiness of Sarah Baker. Piper Perabo here from Coyote Ugly, among other things. She's such a cool chick. She's this grounded, you know, down-to-earth, great woman. And she brings Nora to life in a way that I thought was really good. I mean, there's a lot of these roles that could have simply been one of the 12. But I thought that each actor did a great job at individualizing them with enough specificity that you really got a read on who's who.
Honey, you'll keep in touch and you can make new friends.
No,
quiet!
Now look, I know you're all scared. Moving is a big deal. We're very comfortable here. I get that. And that's why I turned down a lot of others.
There's a great line of dialogue coming up, one of the best in the movie, I think, again, written by Sam Harper, where Steve, who kind of never was the golden boy, he articulates the heart of the matter coming up, where he says, "They're finally calling my number." And it's a great line that's delivered perfectly by Steve.
And they're finally calling my number.
You know, you kind of get that this is a dad who knows he's, you know, making a drastic change for his family, but it's because this is his dream come true. And ultimately, you know, this is a movie about dreams coming true and the fact that sometimes in life our dreams shift and the things we wanted are different from the things we now want. And so this is a core scene as far as laying that groundwork.
But in the end, your mother and I are going to do what we think is best for the family.
What's the point of even voting?
These girls here, Liliana Mumy and Morgan York, who play those two girls, they're so good and they come with such individual personalities, and those personalities translated into their characters on screen.
Eight no's, three yeses, and three maybes. Not exactly a mandate. Give me a pen. I'm going to change some of these.
This is a scene that, you know, I think it's a critical scene because, again, as I said earlier, as much as it's a movie about family, it's a movie about marriage. And this scene really plants, you know, the history between these people, the physical intimacy between them, and the love between them. And, you know, the way in which Bonnie's character here kind of stands by her husband's dream and supports him going for it, even though it's going to have big consequences, I think that it's just, you know, it's a really kind of giving, nurturing act, and love this moment between husband and wife.
Yeah.
coming up, we have this smash cut to these musicians playing taps. These are local Northern California boys playing all of the instruments really, really badly, which, of course, is the point. And it's this joke that runs through the scene that they're playing taps and they're kind of mourning the end of their Midland life, but they're playing it so badly. And I think it's just a really funny soundtrack. Here we have Forrest Landis, who plays FedEx, or otherwise known as Mark. And Forrest had never done a movie before, and he's a really young new actor whose face and expressiveness gave me so much as far as investing us in Mark and that character and really feeling for him.
Do me a favor and drive the Cutlass. Thanks for ruining my life.
I don't want to move.
You know what? Everybody's going with us. We're taking all your toys. Okay. Well, whoever said expressing emotion was a good thing, I'd like to see.
Here we have the obligatory moving montage with Life is a Highway, a classic from the mid-80s, I want to say, that I'm told has never before been in a movie, perhaps because it's an unrecognized genius classic song. Anyway, these are second unit shots that Jonathan Brown, my DP, did with Ira Schumann, the co-producer of the movie. Ira, who I've done two movies in a row with him, not only a great line producer, but just a great resource. And he went to Chicago with Jonathan and grabbed those shots. And as you can see, they blend pretty seamlessly with Hancock Park, which is a neighborhood in Los Angeles where we actually shot the exteriors of Evanston.
In here, Dad?
We'll have friends here in no time.
I love this, the kind of two upper class white kids, you know, kind of with the bass pumping in the Mercedes. It just kind of says up front that life is different here, and it may not be a seamless transition for our Baker clan. Jonathan and I shot list everything. We don't like to show up on the day with no idea of how we're going to shoot it, and we often diverge from our shot list. But this, for instance, is a crane shot, kind of where we pan the family over and crane down to reveal the house. A lot of our shots are exactly the way we draw them up when we walk the locations and walk the sets and formulate our game plan.
Hey, Charlie. You're going to need a car to...
I love this moment where Steve and Bonnie ask Tom Welling if the bribery is working. And Welling nails the reading of his response a little bit. It's exactly the inflection I had in my head.
A little bit.
I love this shot because he's showing his pleasure, but not to his parents because he doesn't want to admit it to them. This is a set. It's an unbelievably elaborate, excellent set designed by Nina and her production design team, Nina Ruscio. It's really upscale for a football coach, and I worried about whether we'd gone too upscale. But frankly, the logistics of a family of 14 needed a house of a certain scale. Kevin Schmidt, who plays Henry, love the way he disses FedEx in that moment. It feels exactly the way my brothers and I talked to each other growing up. And again, just every single kid pulled their weight and brought their character to life individually. Again, all of this is built. This is all a built set as Mark comes up and finds a secret room. And Nina, I think, really captured the mixture of spookiness and coolness. It's kind of almost like a Tim Burton hidden space up here. I don't even know why it feels like Tim Burton space, but it's kind of quirky and off-center, and I think the music also, frankly, reflects that. The music, I should mention, is done by Christoph Beck, who has scored all of my movies. Again, I'm kind of clearly unimaginative when it comes to hiring new people, but you know what? When people do great work for you, you want to keep them around. And my team has earned the next movie again and again and again. And Chris Beck, on all three of the films, has proven himself eclectic and capable of doing a vast range of sounds, but nowhere more so than in this movie. We really worked hard to create both an individual and youthful sound without it being kind of, you know, too trendy. And frankly, it ended up being a very classical score at points that I think makes the movie so much better. Alan Ruck here with Paula Marshall, they play the Shanks. Their son's played by Stephen Anthony Lawrence. And the Shanks, you know, yeah, they're the neighbors, yeah, they're supporting roles, but they bring so much comedy to this movie. And, you know, Alan and Paula are true pros. They've both done a huge amount of comedy, and they just know what they're doing. And when you can have a supporting cast like that, you're in good shape.
Dylan doesn't really care for rough play.
You're gonna want to stop.
This is the second big set piece of the movie, the first one being the frog and eggs. And obviously the movie goes really broad at certain points and hopefully, you know, kind of goes there in a fun way without losing the adult viewers. And obviously, I mean, a big part of it is that to have Steve Martin in your movie and not capitalize on his physicality is insanity. Obviously, Steve is an incredibly talented comic, and a big part of what he does is physical. This, again, you know, Ernie Orsatti, the stunt coordinator, really helped a lot with doing this stuff and doubling these actors. And a lot of it, as you can see, is done with the real actors. We had Steve and various people cabled up. This is a really funny little ad here.
A minute and a half we lived here, I really hated that chandelier.
There's that laugh from Stephen Anthony Lawrence that we slipped in, and there's another one here where his voice cracks.
I don't have it. Just love the mom.
Well, then you need to practice for your child.
He came in for ADR, and his voice cracked in one take, and it was so excellent for the role of Dylan that we left it in the movie.
Just come by any time.
Oh, no. We'll come. You're all invited, my brother.
Again, here's an example, Bonnie.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Complete ad lib, like much of what she does. It's just stuff that comes to her in the moment, and when you're editing your movie, you become so grateful for it because it just kind of grounds it in reality.
Hey, Jake, what's up?
I shot this in a different way. I had a wider shot of this in which Steve's in the foreground and Bonnie and Welling are in the background kind of being comedic with the chandelier, but it stole the focus.
Okay, well, we got this.
Dad's got to earn a living!
This is, again, Hancock Park, and my location manager, Steve Maple, did a great job at finding locations that felt Evanston, felt East Coast or Midwest, and similarly here, here's a great example of how every department helped out. My prop guys, my prop master, Gabe Higgins, and his assistant, Matt Keim, the details of simply the clutter and then the amount of objects and the types of objects that you would find everywhere with a family of 14 people. I thought that Gabe did a great job at filling the world with the texture details of real life. This is the secret passageway, which used to, it's interesting because there's no reason for this to be in the movie. I mean, none. In an old draft, the kids used this secret passageway to spy on the evil babysitter. But we took that out of the script, and what got left behind was simply this kind of fun slide that Mark finds in the house. And though it is totally unnecessary and never paid off, the kid audiences really seem to enjoy the wish fulfillment element. Yeah, I'll use this moment to mention the wardrobe. Though it looks kind of simple and fairly straightforward, Sonia Hayes, my wardrobe designer, who did Big Fat Liar for me, she... there was no one else to do this job in my mind. Sonia, you know, whose credits range from Triple X to Fast and the Furious to Blade, you'd think that she would be an odd choice for a family film. And certainly when I hired her on Big Fat Liar, she was an odd choice for a family film. But what she does is she takes a movie that could be totally vanilla and safe and pedestrian and just kind of spices it up with details and wardrobe elements that make it just a little cooler, a little more realistic, and she's just the best at what she does.
Oh yeah, Tom Baker's boy. Read where his old buddy Shake threw him a bone.
Offense or defense?
These actors playing the coach and assistant coach, that's Rex Lynn on the left and David Kelsey on the right. Really good at, I think, capturing the, like, pompous assessment that these coaches are giving Charlie. David Kelsey, who I met on a student film 7 years ago, is a really good actor, and I was glad to, you know, get him in this movie.
OK,
In this scene here, you're going to hear two reporter voices. The first belongs to David Bowe, who's an actor who starred in my student film, Broken Record, many years ago. The second belongs to Kevin Carey, who's actually the grandson of Ernestine Gilbreth Carey, who wrote the original book and movie, Cheaper by the Dozen. So it was kind of, unfortunately, their lines ended up being off camera. But it was a great thrill for all of us to have Ernestine's grandson on our set, and to frankly be able to treat him like a VIP, because though this is an incredibly loose remake, you know, we wanted to be respectful of the source material and the legend that it is. Here we have Blake Woodruff playing Little Mike. I think there's something really realistic about the way he says somebody from something something, because of course kids could not be less interested in taking down the details of a phone message. Blake is a little kamikaze, which is exactly why he got the part, and he just brings Mike to life as a kamikaze. Here's a nice scene coming up between Hilary Duff and Bonnie Hunt. Again, Hilary is like, you know, crazy famous. And yet, she came to work every day as part of the team. And I really respected the fact, particularly given that she's a young actress, and it's a lot to process the degree of celebrity that she's going through. But her work ethic and her discipline and her team spirit were really admirable.
Oh, my God. Can you guys just please wait till I leave the room?
Can you hurry?
That line there, "Can you hurry?" is a Steve Martin ad-lib, which I thought was really funny. This scene here is an example of, you know, when you're a director and you read like a 3-page scene, you know you don't want the actors to just kind of stand still and talk. I talk, you talk, I talk, you talk. So there's a lot of blocking in this scene that's frankly probably a little unnecessary, but I was really wary of keeping the scene from being static so that we're constantly shooting against shifting backgrounds and people are moving, cameras moving, et cetera, et cetera. I would also mention that I directed this scene with a head wound. Literally on my way to the set to rehearse this scene, I walked into the side of my trailer and cut deep into my forehead. So I literally blocked this scene. I knew that I needed stitches, but I didn't want to leave until I blocked a scene. So I blocked that scene with, like, you know, a gauze and like ice pack against my head wound, which sounds a little more glamorous and impressive than it was, but it was heroic in a small artsy way.
I miss you too, but I mean, I gotta get a job. Hi, Lorraine. Okay, I'll try and be there, honey. Hi, Kimmy. Yeah, I know, I haven't been very friendly recently. They are pulling me in again.
Just tell me you can't do it.
Could you guys hold up a second? That's easy for you to say. You're an only child. It might be fun to babysit together.
No! Whoa, no! No, you know what happened last time we visited?
They're welcoming you into the family.
They set me on fire.
Just your pants.
Honey, I am an actor, okay? And sure, last time it was just my pants, but what if next time it's my face? This is the moneymaker. I'm not that good of an actor. This is how I get the jobs. I know that. I'm man enough to admit it.
Please.
Don't look at me like that. Don't look at me like that.
Please, please.
You always do that to me. Fine. You know what? We'll go. But I'll tell you what. One thing happens, and I'm gone. And no flyers. And we sleep in the same room.
Can we put Dad on?
She says she'll help us out if they can stay in the same room.
No way. No, she knows the rules. She wants to have her own room when she's here. Isn't that sweet? No.
Okay, look, why don't you just come over on Sunday and we'll talk logistics. All right. Bye.
Tell me Doorknob Man isn't babysitting too.
Yes, he very well might.
Love these scenes where the kids kind of plot. My career started at Disney Channel and Nickelodeon, so the idea of kids taking down grown-ups is like, it's bread in the bone for me. It's what I've been doing since my student film, which was also about kids. And so, you know, to have actors like Jacob Smith here playing the role of Jake and Liliana Moomy and all of them, you know, Forrest Landis and Shane and Brent Kinsman, to be able to have kids who aren't doing the cutesy kitty actor thing, they're just playing characters, frankly, that I cast them as, because they resembled their real persons it just gives a reality to the movie. Here we have this fictional game of Appelschmier, which no one really ever understood except Sam Harper, who wrote it. The idea is that you throw an apple and someone swings a tennis racket and, like, smashes it to smithereens. I'm going to backtrack also and mention, while I was on the subject of cast, Nancy Clopper cast this movie, and I think it's an exceptionally good job of casting. It was hard. We saw hundreds and hundreds of kids, and we were really determined to go the extra mile, to get kids, frankly, who had never done a movie, who had never done a TV show, some of whom have never appeared on camera, because what we wanted was honest performances. And with Nancy's diligence and good taste, I was able to assemble that cast.
Time out! North!
Now, coming up, we have some really gems of dialogue vis-a-vis the LeBaron. The LeBaron was Sam Harper's idea. For reasons that I really never understood, he gave Hank a LeBaron as the car. He literally said the key to Hank is in him driving a LeBaron, that he thinks it's a choice vehicle. And this is no offense to people who do drive LeBarons, but, you know, the fact that Hank is so protective of his LeBaron kind of makes him, you know, a hilarious dolt. Here comes the takedown. You know, just kind of promiscuous use of slow motion and speed ramps and all kinds of in-camera tricks. Great music by Chris Beck. Cool, funky, and just kind of original. What you're going to see is Jacob Smith, who plays Jake. This is really him skateboarding, and it's not why he got the part, but it certainly added to his appeal. Jacob is a sponsored skateboarder, and he did all his own skateboard stunts personally.
Phase one complete.
Love the silence of this scene. No sound other than the panting of the dog.
Love him dry in no time.
Sorry about your clothes, Hank, but have them dry in no time.
Bonnie was actually in the kitchen cooking a hamburger during that scene as we originally shot it. I later restructured it and needed to get Bonnie out of the shot. And so thanks to the incredible tools available to filmmakers these days, tools that I don't even slightly understand, frankly, we were able to make her vanish. And that's largely due to Brad Wilhite, my assistant editor, who had a huge, huge role in the making of this movie. And kind of, frankly, it was his idea in a lot of instances to do the sky replacements, to do the paint out of a character. Great sound element there, by the way. If you go back and rewind it without my voice, they wanted a sound. This is a sound storm. They created a sound when that bucket gets opened. It's like the Ark being opened in Raiders of the Lost Ark. I love that sound element. Now, this scene here, 100% improv.
With the gargling, the mouthwash ad?
You know, the remarkable thing about my career is I only started acting a month ago, and I'm already on TV. It's the real deal. The career is white hot, Tom. It's on fire.
I read that most actors end up in the food service industry.
That's not going to happen to Hank, Kim.
Candidly, I think Nora's right. It's getting so as I can hardly go out in public anymore. I mean, really, with between the autograph hounds and the paparazzi.
Autographs and everything? I mean, just the one commercial and then you have paparazzi.
Yeah, I've never actually seen them, but, you know, they hide in the bush and they get their shot. The crazy thing is that now we're trying to sit at home like regular Joes, and we're watching TV, right? And boom.
I should also mention that this scene was five times longer, to the point where this scene was hilarious and really, really long. I wanted it to be longer, but once I started showing it to audiences, I realized that it overstayed its welcome. And that's kind of what you learn oftentimes in comedy, that just because something is funny, more doesn't equal better. Sometimes more makes it decreasingly funny. So this here, by the way, one of the best lines in the movie, this is ad-lib Bonnie.
Nora, stop! Yeah, mm-hmm. Want to help me in the kitchen get a pie? Look at a picture of Grandma, say the rosary. Come on, kids, here we go, everybody out.
you know, obviously I mentioned it about like 90 times already, but that's the genius and the gift of having Bonnie Hunt in your movie is, yeah, you never know what you're going to get, but what you get is often gold. This scene didn't really work, frankly. The idea was that the dog was kind of rabid in his desire to get to the underwear. Frank, look, Mike Alexander, the animal trainer on this movie, did a great job with the dog. But I feel like I didn't shoot it to really create the voracious appetite of the dog going after the meat underwear. This, I think, works much better.
Kate, is this orange juice freshly squeezed? Nora and I are on a bit of an organic diet. We're only going with the organic, freshly squeezed. And it tastes a bit like Tropicana.
He's the winner.
I think that the music in this scene is once again fantastic by Chris Beck. You know, we edited this scene about 30 different ways. George Folsey and I, and with Bob Simons, my fantastic producer, we really experimented with different versions of this scene and ultimately found that showing less of the dog in the groin made it funnier. Kind of people's reactions were in a way funnier than the actual attack.
You're digging in.
Fantastic line there. He's really digging in. Some great sound work also. Obviously, there's a lot of growling and moaning from the dog, but the licking sounds, I think, are particularly choice. You know, it's funny because the gift of having so many, you know, kind of recognizable actors in a movie is that you can line up a two-shot of Tom Welling and Hilary Duff as background characters. I mean, that's a huge luxury and a treat, frankly, for an audience, much like Soderbergh was able to do in Ocean's 11. And it's like, wow, it's really cool to see Brad Pitt and Matt Damon and George Clooney in the same frame, you know, on a admittedly much smaller scale. I had the luxury of framing shots with several kind of big stars in the same frame, and that's, you know, the fact that those stars are also good actors and giving you great performance, that's even better.
Nora, would you please get...
These are fake dogs. Half of those dogs are CGI duplications of the real dogs.
It's gonna be
in the living room now. Let's go.
This is actually a really good job by the animal trainers. There were like 9 or 10 trainers on the set that day because we had to get each dog individually to go nuts on the window. The fact that we actually didn't even have to loop that scene, as I think about it, is even more miraculous. Now, I should mention, the entire idea of soaking underwear in meat is Steve Martin's. There was this prank where the kids went after Hank, and I had dinner with Steve Martin and Bob Simons, the producer, and Hutch Parker from Fox. And Steve goes, you know, what if they, like, did something different? Like, I don't know, soak his underwear in meat. And we just lost it, because not only is that a funny sentence, but the idea behind it is so kind of absurd and funny that it stuck. So all this entire sequence, the attack of Hank, the soaking of underwear in meat, and all of the dialogue was really stuff that Steve pitched over dinner and I wrote down on a napkin. Now this, however, is a different story. This beep, 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 this was an idea that the kids had. This literally, it was like a couple of the 7 and 8-year-olds on set gave Steve the idea of having like an evil meter in his hand. And Steve liked the idea, I liked the idea, and it's a good story as far as illustrating the vibe that I like to have on set. My motto has always been, best idea wins. I don't care whose idea it is, I want the best one. And frankly, it's like when you're starting out, you think that the way that you assume your authority is by declaring the way that things are going to be, but once you settle into directing, you realize that actually a lot of it is about having the confidence to take other people's ideas, even if it comes from literally a 6-year-old cast member. And I'm really grateful for their input because it works. I would add that the whole vibe on this movie was chaotic. Making the movie was madness, and that was not only the case on set, but at base camp where the kids stayed in their trailers. It was like summer camp every single day of the shoot. Make sure they get to school.
school on time. It's their first day, so you know how nervous they're going to be, all right? And kids, don't worry. Mom can be...
This is another scene with, you know, like 8, 9 kids. And a lot of people have asked me how I did that in terms of just the logistics of directing so many kids. And the truth is, it was really, really hard. You know, half of these kids didn't even realize they were in a movie. The other half occasionally weren't in the mood to be in a movie. And, like, how do you get performance from a kid who's like, okay, I'm done being in the movie now? You know, it's like they don't care that they have a responsibility or that they're getting paid or all of this stuff. So a lot of the way I worked with these kids came down to just becoming really immature and relating to them on their level and playing with them and, you know, kind of trying to get them in the mood and inspired through my own energy. And that was really the key. With directing kids, it's not what you say, it's how you say it, and it's how you relate to them.
Dylan's birthday party is coming up. You can get all hopped up.
I should mention that the whole kind of vampire thing that Steve Martin does, that was his idea, and it's another just great example of when you have someone that good and they're bringing their A game, they're constantly throwing great ideas at you. Another really good example of song choice by Dave Jordan, my music supervisor, and also with excellent work throughout the film by Terry Wilson, my music editor on Big Fat Liar and on this. And obviously, I know I'm kind of, there's a theme here of kind of repeat business, of keeping my team together. And it's because I do believe in it, not simply because of loyalty, but because there is a shorthand developed, and it makes the work easier and a lot more fun. I'll come back to this theme, but there's always been this kind of unspoken joke to me that Tom Welling goes to a school where people are so tall and good-looking that he's the outcast. We affectionately refer to that school as Model High because everyone is beautiful and great bodies and like 6'7". Here's a great example of how Forrest as Mark brings everything we need in his face. Right there. You get that kid. No words. And that's why I cast him.
Hi! Oh, look at you, Diane.
It's you. You did not have 12 kids.
Yes, I did.
Girl, I can't even manage a boyfriend.
This is a nice scene between these characters. That's Bonnie, obviously, and Vanessa Bell Calloway, who, you know, plays Diane Phillips. And this shot right there of the book, we shot that on a train platform at Union Station because I didn't have time to get that insert. So we brought in some carpet to the train station platform and laid it right there and lit it to match. I thought Jonathan and Tony Nocco, my exceptional gaffer on this movie, or Jonathan's gaffer, rather, he's done huge shows like X-Men Next 2 and just really brought a great quality of lighting to this movie, I think.
There's no book.
Part of Jonathan's and my approach is to not do the good enough job. There's often the attitude that, well, you do a good enough job. Hey, it's a comedy. It's a family movie. We'll do a good enough job. Uh-uh, that doesn't work for us. We want the movie to look beautiful, and I don't care that it's a family film, and I don't want to settle for lower aesthetic standards because it's a comedy. I don't know where that's written, but I certainly don't subscribe to it. Here, this is the kids having fun. I literally, you know, I have Blake Woodruff rappelling out the window. I have one of the Kinsman twins jumping on the trampoline. And again, it's just consistent with the whole motif of keep everything chaotic. This is a centerpiece scene of the movie. This is, I think I even remember the scene number. I think it's scene 106. This is one big Steadicam shot that goes for quite a while. There are cuts in it, but I shot the scene in one shot. And it's because I wanted a fluid sense of chaos. I didn't want to create that. You see, we're so far, there's still, that's our first cut, and then we come back to the same Steadicam shot. It was a lighting challenge for Jonathan and an operating challenge, and I'm so happy we did it, because look at this. It's like he goes somewhere, something happens, goes to another area, boom, she leaves, she comes. I really wanted an unconstructed chaos. I wanted real chaos. I wanted real pace, and the only way to do that is to shoot it literally in real time in one shot.
Put him on the table, please.
What the? Mike's athletic cup? Ow!
I've been very gratified in test screenings to get the comment from a lot of audience members that this is one of their most memorable scenes. It's not one of the big set pieces, but for me, it's a key scene as far as creating the hurly-burly of their life in this home. Yeah, okay, I'm not a proud man. I go for the vomit joke because it's funny. So I apologize to no one but myself.
I'm in puke!
Are you all right?
This is something that I came up with on set. You've mopped it up with your back, and then he vomits too. None of that was in the script, the double vomit, but as we're shooting it, it occurred to me that it might be funny to topspin the joke even again, and that's why we did it. But again, this scene took us, I think, almost 2 days to shoot. There is a lot of pieces to it. There's a lot of coverage, and what you don't see is that there are, in the full version of this scene, there were three other kids who came in. That's Wayne Knight, a.k.a. Newman, playing our chandelier man really funnily.
Are you all right?
Of course he'd be dead in real life, but he bounces right up because it's a movie.
I will call. I'm just, my wife is out of town.
I love how Steve says my wife is out of town, as if that's kind of the apology that is like a shorthand for why things are so bad, is my wife's out of town. Like, that explains everything. Again, if you listen to this scene without my talking, you'll hear just layer upon layer of great, great sound work. There's about 30 different things going on at once, and it really creates the atmosphere we want.
Hello.
Hi. How's it going?
This scene did not exist. This is a phone conversation that never happened. What I mean by that is this. There used to be two separate phone conversations. What I've done is I've taken Bonnie's side from phone conversation A, and I've edited it artificially with Steve's side of phone conversation B, which in reality occur half an hour apart in the movie, but I made it one scene. So literally, this was us digging through the footage to find anything that could sell it. Like this thing right... See that what? That is Steve Martin talking to me, because I spoke to him from behind the camera and he was saying, "What, Sean?" But I cut out the Sean and I used it as part of the dialogue to create the illusion that Bonnie and Steve are actually having this conversation. We ended up combining these conversations to move the plot forward with kind of a more aggressive pace, and I think that George Folsey did an incredible job. I mean, Folsey's edited like, you know, 30, 40 movies, and it's he said it's one of the kind of the most zany things he's done, to literally create a phone conversation that never happened.
And it's the sweetest thing. They formed a little study group.
It's all stolen footage. This thing here with the hatchet coming through the door.
Think tank thing.
Everybody questioned that. Everyone on set was like, why an axe? Like, they wouldn't have an axe. Do you really want an axe? I'm like, I know it's kind of ludicrous, and that's why it's funny. Great ADR off camera right here. Again, I had the twins in doing their ADR, and at the last minute, I had this idea to have them do a wild line. Don't hide in the closet, Dad. Take it like a man. And it ends up being the button,
yeah?
A really funny button to the scene.
Okay.
Of course, we have the obligatory source song playing in the background of the teenager's room.
Mom's not coming home for a couple of weeks.
That aside, I think this is a really nice scene between Hillary and Steve.
Okay. Up till now, I've been, like, mellow about this whole having-it-all lifestyle that you and Mom are currently into. A, because Sarah has the drama queen role totally covered.
Once again, I should mention that the depth of good work that you see in a movie, you really see it as a director more than anyone, because I've seen this movie, you know, like 300 times, and so my eye wanders. And what you end up stumbling on are the details, the small kind of nuances of performance, the small kind of details of set decoration. So again, a shout out to Nina Ruscio and her team, Scott Meehan, my art director, and Casey Fox, the set decorator, because it's those small things that maybe 99 out of 100 people don't notice, but the one who does gets kind of a depth to the reality that's being sold that much more. And I'll tell you what, it certainly impresses me. Coming up here is a really good cover of the Beatles song Help. licensing the Beatles wasn't going to happen. So what I looked for was a cover of the Beatles that I liked, and I couldn't find a single one that existed. At that time, I was listening to the Fountains of Wayne CD, Welcome Interstate Managers, which my I had an apprentice, kind of an intern over the summer named Ben Greenblatt, who, you know, kind of, I said, what music should I be listening to if I want to kind of feel or stay current and young? And he slipped me this CD by Fountains of Wayne. I fell in love with the CD. So when it was time to hire someone to cover the Beatles, I said Fountains of Wayne is my first choice. And Robert Kraft, who's the head of music at 20th Century Fox, along with Danielle Diego, my music executive, they went to Adam Schlesinger of Fountains of Wayne, and he did that great cover of Help. Again, it's just, I'm always amazed at how this scene, by the way, wasn't in the movie. This is something I shot 5 months later because I wanted to keep the Charlie story alive and his unhappiness to keep it tracking. The fact that he doesn't want to be there, that he misses his girlfriend. So that's a new scene. I want to go back. Sometimes it's the smallest thing that ends up being a part of your movie. You know, for instance, if I hadn't had that high school student interning for me over the summer, if he hadn't slipped me that CD, then I wouldn't have had the Fountains of Wayne idea. We wouldn't have gotten Fountains of Wayne. We would have had a worse cover or maybe, you know, a different song altogether. So you never know, but I tend to think that things occur, not to sound too new age ooey ooey, but things do tend to kind of work for certain reasons, and that's been my experience.
Hello. Yeah.
Again, Gabe Higgins, my prop master. I love the details of the things that are on her nightstand. I love that her key is there. I love that her cell phone is charging there because that just kind of feels like the way it would happen. What the heck is that thing there with the bowling pins? Again, great example of art direction and production design. I don't know what it is. You don't know what it is, but it looks like some kind of kid. Oh, here we are back at Model High, where everyone's beautiful and tall and skinny. The reason that we went this way, by the way, all kidding aside, is that Welling said to me, look, if I'm going to go head-to-head with someone, then you got to make them taller. Because Welling is a big boy. He's like 6'3". And yet, I cast, you know, a bully playing this role of Luke to whom Welling has to look up. His name is Jared Padalecki, by the way, playing the bully. And you can see how tall they are by how short Hilary Duff looks. Look at him getting dissed at Model High again. Damn, it's tough there among the models.
I got a real shot with this.
Again, you know, like, no one will notice this, but the song that's playing in the background is a song that my assistant, Gene Repke, picked up off of a free sampler at, like, Virgin, and I liked it. It was kind of this Latin-themed hip-hop song, and it's ended up in the movie. I really like Welling's performance here. He's kind of awkward and embarrassed, and yet he is somebody he's got to talk to his dad about.
My new school?
Press is waiting, babe.
They're out there now?
Yeah, come on, get dressed.
Hey, can we do this later?
This is a section of the movie that I restructured massively. This structure bears no resemblance to the script. And it's largely due to the fine editorial work of George Folsey, but even more so to the form of collaboration I have with Bob Simons, my producer, on Just Married and this. You know, we do an assembly. We watch the assembly. And for us, our process is very much then about stripping away everything until you can find the spine of the movie, which in this case was, what is Steve Martin's journey? What is Tom Baker's arc? And once you can find the spine and identify it and follow it, then you kind of additively start adding back the flavor and kind of the supporting characters and all of the things that make the spine, you know, have vertebrae, to go with the kind of odd metaphor. And that's kind of how we did it. And so we literally, once we're editing, the script has to be disrespected because the structure of the script may have worked. But once you see the movie as a living, breathing thing, you got to structure it and tell that story the way that movie wants to be told. Great performance here, as always. Richard Jenkins is just one of those actors. I've loved him since I saw him in the fantastic David O. Russell movie, Flirting with Disaster. And he's just always good.
You know, it's hard to believe someone as staggeringly beautiful as...
Very nice cameo from Regis and Kelly.
...still look as yummy as you do.
I should also mention that none of this was scripted.
Sweet, I guess the camera can't see my hips.
Both Kelly's line coming up and Bonnie's response. Really good improv, as always, from Ms. Hunt.
Well, after the sixth one, they just kind of walked out.
Why don't you read us a little something from your book?
Oh... I don't know. No, people can just buy it and then read it.
Oh, come on.
What's coming up, by the way, is a scene where Steve has gathered the team at his home. And, by the way, I should mention, I wasn't there when Bonnie shot this. I don't know that I've ever properly thanked Regis and Kelly. So, in case I still haven't spoken to them by the time this DVD comes out, thank you guys. You're really good in the movie. This is an additional shot right here of Hilary Duff. This idea of her coming out with, like, a mask on, totally mortified in front of college guys, that was Bob Simon's idea. I had had the idea that I wanted to do a cutaway of Hillary in this scene because I felt like she vanished for too long a period. And again, it's because she's busy and she only had a certain number of days available to shoot with us. So we were able to go back and not only lace her into this scene, but with Bob's idea to do so comedically. Now, what we have coming up is what we call the juggling of work and family montage. It's a very, very long montage. And we use this really good Sum 41 song that is not contemporary. It's actually a year or two old, but it works so well lyrically and thematically that I didn't care about being cutting edge. And what you'll see is pretty much, in a certain way, this montage is a microcosm of the second act. It tells the story of a man juggling his dream of career and his dream of family, and slowly you have the deterioration of one in favor of the other, which is to say his family life is being sacrificed. So I'll let you watch.
Hey, out of New York.
While we're watching this montage, just a couple of other people that I have to mention because they did such good work for me. John Hatchett has been my key grip on all of my movies, and him and Tommy Ruffner, my dolly grip, and his whole team of grips. You know, like, there's some directors who, I guess, you know, never even know their grips. You know, it's like you kind of work with the actors or you're dealing with the studio and your crew kind of is on a different level. That doesn't work for me because my boys are the ones making my movie. And yeah, you have to kind of do the housekeeping stuff with the studio, and obviously you want to devote the bulk of your time to your actors. But, you know, John Hatchett, for instance, who's been my key grip on all of my movies, he's not just there laying track for me at his lunch hour and working his butt off to get whatever needs to be done. He'll suggest rigs. He'll suggest a place that I would have thought impossible to mount a camera, but he's got an idea, a design idea, that makes for a really cool shot. So, again, you know, you got to respect the contribution of everyone because they're all professionals kind of bringing their A-game on behalf of your vision, and that's a generous act.
Something tells me you had an unpleasant interaction with those boys, Mark.
He knocked my glasses off.
I love this nose-to-nose confrontation. You know, I love that it's kind of tough and serious, but it has this joke regarding the latte, which is an excellent Sam Harper joke.
My latte!
I should actually, while I'm watching this, it occurs to me that we looped very, very little of the movie. That's me, by the way, in an unfortunate cameo that I now regret having done. There I am attempting to portray the disappointed reporter who's being dissed by the head coach. Anyway, the production sound by Obie, otherwise known as David Obermeier, I've never had to loop less than on this movie, and this is in spite of a set that was absolute chaos all the time, with dogs and kids, and not only the kids. I mean, that's kind of the thing that people don't realize is that it wasn't just 14 people on set, because every kid was there with two or three siblings and parents. So literally, I had like a cluster of 45 people at the monitor, and it was very, very crowded, and there were a lot of eyes and a lot of opinions and a lot of voices. But again, you know, best idea wins, and that's always been my credo, so I didn't mind it so much. I've always believed, and I talked about this, I think, on both The Big Fat Liar and Just Married DVDs, you can't make a movie that has a boisterous energy without having a set that has a boisterous energy. I'm not that good of a director that I can create something, you know, out of thin air. I need to create something that's an extension of me and my energy and my set, and that's the way I know how to work. There's Steve Martin with the really flamboyant socks. Steve, you know, whose wardrobe is great, and Sonia, as always, did a great job on wardrobe. For some reason that I never fully understood, Steve wanted Coach Baker to have eccentric sock choices. So you'll notice, these are almost every scene where you see his socks, there's some really brightly colored pair.
Come on. Come on.
This scene coming up again with Forrest Landis. Forrest has done very little acting, and this is a big critical part, but it's all in his face. And I knew that he had one of those faces where we would fall in love and invest in that character, not through anything he said, but through those eyes. Here we have the Shank party, which is obviously kind of a sly comment on these upper class parties for kids that are really more about adults.
Tabernacle Choir too. Whatever happened to pin the tail on the donkey?
And on the end around, the guard pulls.
Again, this is all a set. All of this, everything you're seeing is a set, and what we did that's unconventional is we built a two-story set for real. Usually we will, you know, you build one story and then next to it you build the second story. But I wanted a real two-story set because, as you'll see later in the movie, there are shots that carry people from downstairs to upstairs, from upstairs to downstairs. And I wanted that fluid movement to communicate that that's the way life is, constantly moving energy with a family that big. And in fact, you know, building this house, I'm sure, and I think actually did cost more than building a real house in some ways. Another great music cue by Christoph Beck. This is what I call my Abbey Road shot. A lot of directors, when they read a script, they see the shots from the get-go. I'm not that way. When I read a script, I'm usually picturing performance and hearing performance. Occasionally, I will see a specific shot from my very first read, and the Abbey Road shot is one of those shots.
Want to play catch with the football I got you?
My nanny'd have to check with my dad. He'd have to check with my mom.
Love the bongos in this cue.
An inappropriate use of free time.
Sounds like a yes to me. We'll get him.
You know, it's not every composer that can move so comfortably from grooves like this to big orchestral classic score. Another ADR bit here that I really like. Listen.
Run, Billy, run!
Run, Billy, run! Look, I think when you're making a comedy, everywhere is an opportunity for a joke. So I go to my loop group sessions, which are when you do all the crowd voices, and I had this idea to have one of the loop group actors start the kind of bedlam with Run, Billy, Run. Here we have, we ended up underslinging this snorkel cam and doing snake POV. This was really hard because, as you can see, it's, you know, 100 extras who had to look freaked out and run everywhere, and you're directing actors, and this was just absolute madness. It was 2 days in that backyard, and there were cranes and wires because we had people flying out of the moon mounts coming up, and it was just really, really, it was challenging, but in the end, I think it works. Coming up, we have the Moon Bounce set piece. And again, you know, my producer, Bob Simons, the reason I've liked working with him, and my next movie is going to be with him as well, is that he lets me make my movie. He's there when I need him, and frankly, he's conspicuously not there when I want to be kind of just working in my own space. But this idea here, in the script originally, the moon bounce exploded because someone threw a fork at it, and he felt that we needed to tee up the joke in a more satisfying way. That's his terminology, to tee it up. So the idea of blocking the outflow vent in order to inflate the moon mount so you know it's coming. That's a Bob Simons idea that totally defines the nature of this sequence, I think. This is one of my favorite shots. This shot here, the slow motion raining down on Dylan Shank. It's just really funny to me. Coming up here, the cut to the hospital, that's a fake missing tooth and a fake black eye done CGI by Digital Filmworks and Paul Bolger over there. I thought that it would be, actually, again, that's a Brad Wilhite idea, my assistant editor, thought that it would be even funnier if Dylan Shank were saying it was his best birthday party ever, in spite of the fact that he's clearly injured. Benjamin Fitch, who plays that bespectacled reporter, good young actor.
Sarah from Evanston, you're on with Kate Baker.
Mom, it's Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Is everything okay?
Come home.
Love the lighting in this scene. I kind of, Jonathan, we're big fans of Robert Richardson's, who kind of, you know, did JFK and just very big, famous cinematographer who uses very strong, direct, harsh top light and then bounces it from below, which is how Jonathan and Tony Nocco lit that scene. I love the look of it.
Dad?
Oh, Nora. Nora, thanks for coming.
You know, the thing about Piper in this role that I like is she just feels like a big sister to me. You know, I am an elder sibling, and there's something about the way she relates to the kids and relates to Dad that just feels real. You know, this cutaway to the twins is worth commenting on because one thing that we worked on, we previewed the movie, and it previewed very well. But one of the notes that I got back from Tom Rothman and Hutch Parker and Vanessa Morrison at the studio was that the movie, in its first iteration, it felt like a bifurcated film, where the first half was all comedy, and the second half was all kind of heavy. And so a lot of what we did between the first and the second preview was to kind of interlace the comedy with seriousness, and the seriousness with comedy, which is why in the midst of an otherwise somber scene, we have the kids, the twins, hitting each other with the placards, so that the movie, except for the very end, when we commit wholeheartedly to poignance, to always kind of almost schizophrenically go back and forth between comedy and drama.
You know, great, but I'm really going to need your guys' help, okay? We're talking Baker's full force. Boys, you clean up the outside, girls the inside. I want everybody in fancy, nice, clean clothes. And Tom, if you could please just supervise this one last thing, I would really appreciate it. Okay? All right. Bye.
Sounds like somebody got his Jimmy whipped.
Wayne Knight, he's so funny. He's so good. And we had cut that gag differently. You know, the conventional way is to show the person land, that you cut out of the wide shot as they're leaving the frame, and you cut into the floor shot as they're landing. And we did it that way because that's kind of the basic rule. But it was funnier to me literally having him complete the fall out of frame, below frame, and just hearing the dull thud. Again, there's an example, like that kind of the you know, over-the-top loudness of the pebble throw. That's something that the Soundstorm team did, the sound team did, that makes a joke where none existed. I love the ridiculous wardrobe here with, like, the 70s zippers, and or I guess it would be 80s, I'm not sure. But once again, Sonya Hayes just being the champ she is with wardrobe design. Again, you know, here's an example where the score is really kind of just sweet and sweeping and romantic, that the same composer can go so fluidly from this to something hip and just a great groove is a testament to Chris Beck. The movie is mixed phenomenally well. Paul Massey and Jim Bolt, who were our mixers, just did a great job because, as I said earlier, this is a hard movie. There is a lot going on, and there are a ton of layers. So the fact that they were able to balance it and make the important things audible and the background stuff just kind of felt rather than heard, that's great mixing.
I'm getting there as soon as I can. Sorry.
Okay. Hey, those are for Oprah's people.
Is the house clean?
We're working on it, Kate.
Okay, I'll see you when I see you.
Okay, guys, good job. Now go inside and get cleaned up. Come on, hustle up, let's go.
I mentioned earlier that Jonathan Brown, my DP, and I shot list a lot. That said, we will always change on the day for the sake of backlight. And the movie, as you can see, there's virtually not a single exterior shot that's not naturally backlit, and it makes all the difference. Coming up, we have the cameramen from the Oprah show show up, and they're played by Elon Gold and Dax Shepard. Dax is of punked fame, and I actually met Dax because, as I think I mentioned earlier, I was an accomplice in the series premiere of Punked. Dax and I met there, and he's just a really funny, great up-and-coming talent who's gotten so recognizable that he's no longer on Punked, but he's doing movies instead. And though he has a small role in this movie, every time he comes on screen, every teenager in the audience starts whispering, "That's Dax, that's Dax." So I'm lucky to have him. He's really, really funny, and yet a lot of what Dax does is improvisational, and the movie simply didn't have the time to stop for brilliant Dax and Elon improv.
I'm looking out for number one, especially you and Mom.
Your mother and I are doing what we think is best for everyone.
Whoa, 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 you did not take this coaching job for us. You took this because you were a loser in college while Shake was out there being a superstar. If you want your shot at glory, Dad, if you want to have it all...
This scene here is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. We worked really hard on it, and we did that in two ways. First of all, we talked about the scene quite a bit, particularly Tom Welling and I. We had dinner, and we literally talked about the scene both in terms of its broad strokes and its dynamic, and then line by line. But nothing prepared us for this moment where Steve goes right here is exceptional.
Charlie, I love you. I want you to have the best life you can have. And that means you are getting a diploma.
When I graduate, I'm gone.
This is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many people who've seen the movie, one of Steve Martin's best performances of his career. And, you know, I can't take credit for it beyond a certain extent. Certainly there are things that I did in terms of my approach with Steve that helped. But Steve was just at a place in his work and in his life where he was really willing to go to kind of honest places. And for a guy who, you know, doesn't have a son, to capture the fierce love that a parent has for a child, the way he says, "I love you, I want you to have the best life you can have, that means you're getting a diploma," that moment is unreal. And I'll tell you, when it happened on set, everybody got chills. We literally all turned and looked to each other while we were rolling, and people just couldn't believe it, because I don't know that I've ever seen Steve Martin go to such an unexpected, just so tender, moving place. And I'm so grateful to him for having brought that in this movie.
How are you?
I'm sorry. Hi.
Hi. Charlie got kicked off the football team.
What?
Don't worry, I'm handling it. Shake. President Gerhardt.
Tom, we need a minute.
Please don't die, Beans.
You know, we always wondered whether people would understand that the frog was sick, because, of course, the frog still looks like the frog. The thing that saved us was sound effects. That croak tells the story, and I think it absolutely saved us. This shot here, these shots of the twins, they weren't part of the scene. And again, I went back and shot those shots 5 months later, especially this zinger coming up right here, because, A, I wanted to keep the twins present, but I wanted to keep the comedy present. I didn't want the movie to become, as it frankly did without the twins, the movie here becomes very serious. And I'm willing to go there, but not quite yet. So cutting away the twins helped. Another example of trying to keep things from going too heavy too soon is all the sound effects right here as Bonnie climbs her way through the mess.
I'm going to go get ready.
Oh. Sorry, Dad.
You know, like, there's an example where if it weren't a two-story set, I couldn't have shot that shot in as big a way. Just kind of being able to see the depth downstairs, and you'll see better of examples elsewhere in the movie, it just creates a sense of real space. And I think, frankly, that the reward for that is the number of people who assume that this is a real house.
Chief, get dressed, and get downstairs.
Piper is so good in this movie, and she's good because the role of Nora, it's not a massive role. It doesn't have a huge number of lines. But when played by a good actor like Piper, she's always present. And if you watch the movie and you watch the way Piper reacts, you see what good acting is. It's not just how you say the words. It's what you are doing without words.
No, I want a lot of things. So do you. That's the problem.
This isn't working.
Yeah, that's my point.
I meant the zipper.
Coming up, you're going to see, frankly, the single shot which justified building this very expensive two-story set. It's a shot on a techno crane that tracks the entire family from the upper story to the bottom, all one shot starting now. And it also pans like 240 degrees.
Everything's great. We're a big, happy family.
This was the first time I'd used the techno crane, which is essentially a retractable arm crane. And I'd heard that it's awesome. It's that awesome. I'd want to do every shot with the techno crane. And later on, you'll see the result of my having fallen in love with the techno crane. With the help of my grips, it allowed me to kind of design shots that couldn't have been done with any other piece of equipment.
What's the name of this segment again?
If you watch the scene without my commentary, you'll hear a lot of ADR because this scene played like just kind of a cacophonous din. And what we did is we went back and we looped every single family member with specific arguing lines so that you could pick details out of the morass of sound.
Honey, you can't want this. That's why you're with me.
This was a very complicated day, and it took a lot of energy out of the cast, because obviously every single take they had to fight with each other. One of the ways that we relieved stress was Steve plays banjo. He's this incredibly talented banjo player. And so on occasion, Steve would show up on set with his banjo and serenade the cast and crew with his banjo playing, which just kind of not only provided a nice break, but frankly, it's awesome to see Steve Martin kind of in that way. It's not a side of him that we've seen. Here comes the techno crane that I love the most. There were rafters in this set, and if you look, there's two things noteworthy in this scene. Number one is the way that the camera goes up through the rafters, which we couldn't have done except with the techno crane. The other is why I designed the shot this way. I needed Mark, played by Forrest, to cry in the scene over his dead frog. I knew that Forrest, he just doesn't have the training to cry on cue. So I knew I could fake it by designing a shot that played on his back. And that's why that shot in that way.
Feel free to sleep on the couch.
You read my mind.
Daddy, are you and Mommy going to get a divorce?
Coming up is another example of the ways just kind of a random thing will shape a movie. This music cue is a piece of music called Classical Gas, which was composed, you know, several decades ago. And here's the story of Classical Gas. I saw a movie called Story of Us several years ago with it's like Bruce Willis, Michelle Pfeiffer, Rob Reiner directed it, and there is a montage in that movie that uses this music, and it's a great, great montage, and the music struck me emotionally when I saw that movie years ago. But long after I had forgotten the film, my DP, Jonathan Brown, gave me an iPod, and he preloaded a bunch of songs on it, and one of them was Classical Gas, and I happened to be listening to it while I was filming this movie, and that's how it ended up in the movie.
It's me!
Oh.
Mark's missing.
Oh.
Take it to the max. Tell me, Max.
Let's go.
I look great.
Did you not hear?
Again, love the production design in this set. The paint color is just, you know, the yellows and the reds. It's just, I love this. I love the design of this location, which was a practical location that Nina tailored for us.
Oh, what do you want?
Here's a good example of kind of good creative work from your team. Sonia Hayes, my wardrobe designer, she came up with this idea, even though the scene takes place at like 10:30 at night. She said, what if the Shanks had just come back from a black tie affair? We don't know that. We don't say that. But it's kind of this implied backstory in the wardrobe choice. And, you know, she didn't have to have that idea. They could have all been in pajamas, but she took an idea and made it just a little more original. And I think that that's what you want out of your crew members. Again, cinematography and lighting that is just so pretty, so much more contrasty, and just on an aesthetic level that we often don't see in comedies, because Jonathan Brown doesn't believe in lighting things like a comedy. He lights it like a movie, and the fact that it's a comedy, that's my business.
They're totally to blame.
Again, Classical Gas. You know, we tried to replace this song, but in the end, sometimes you fall so in love with the temp that it's unreplaceable, and that proved to be the case with this. This sequence coming up of Steve looking for his son Mark, I love the intensity and kind of desperation in his performance. It's just so visceral and nowhere more moving than in Love This Shot as well as the next. It just kind of feels like a big movie. And coming from the relatively modest beginnings that Jonathan Brown and I do with Big Fat Liar, it's nice to get a sense of scope. This moment here, when Steve sees his son, it just kills. This was the first time on this movie that I employed a technique that I occasionally use when I'm directing, and that is the playing of music on set. In other words, and this is a Peter Weir technique that Peter Weir is kind of one of my idols, and so I fully credit this as a page stolen from his playbook. When you have a scene that has no dialogue, what you'll do occasionally, or what I do occasionally, is I will play music on the set while I'm rolling. And it proved to be really effective with an actor like Steve Martin, who is obviously like genius and super smart and thinks a great deal. And so what I did is a few places, I played music while we were filming the scene. And it had the effect of kind of shortcutting the cerebral process and making it a visceral one. And Steve came to me afterwards on this occasion and on another that I'll talk about and said, keep doing that because it's working. This is an example of a scene where the adults in the cast were instrumental in helping me with the kids. Like, this scene was crazy. It was our first day up in Petaluma, and, you know, frankly, the kids were all very distracted, and if it weren't for Tom Welling and Bonnie Hunt and Piper and Hillary helping me corral the kids, there's no way I could have done it alone. This beat here, we'd be like 11. The note that I kind of had in my mind was, it reminded me of that excellent Keanu Reeves moment in Parenthood when he says, you know, anyone can get a license to, or you need a license to drive a car, but anyone can become a parent. And then he kind of has this beat where he goes, you know, it's like that kind of horrified shiver. Well, Jacob Smith, who plays Jake, he didn't know that moment, but I did, and that's what I had in my head, and that's why I directed that beat that way, because Parenthood, as I mentioned at the beginning of this commentary, was always on my mind as kind of a watermark to shoot for, and that's one of the moments that stuck with me from Parenthood. This scene here, okay, Beans' funeral. Structurally, the movie does not need this scene. And I must admit that I advocated cutting this scene in script stage. And Hutch Parker and Vanessa Morrison at Fox were like, no, shoot it. We think you need it. Well, here's what happened. Steve Martin came to me the day before we shot it, and he said, you know what? I've kind of, you know, had a go at rewriting the scene. And he pitched me this hip-hop, hopper, he loved hip-hop monologue. And it was pretty funny. So we shot it that way. But what I didn't anticipate is that after all the emotion of the last 10-15 minutes, the audience desperately wants to laugh. They need to exhale. And this scene is key as far as the emotional rhythm of the movie, because you've had all this crying and all this heaviness, and Steve's hip-hop frog burial eulogy gives them the laugh they're craving. This is a fake sky, fake light in the window. Again, good digital effects. this scene here was longer, and you can go to the deleted scenes and see it in its longer version. But this is really the decision moment where Steve looks back at the yearbook, which kind of represents the things he wanted. And now he looks at the things he wants, and he makes a decision. That's Steve's stunt double, Bobby Oregi. He's doubled Steve for years. And if, now that I've told you that, and if you go back and watch it, you'll totally see that it's not Steve Martin's walk.
Signing after the season shake.
This was another set, customized. This was in the DWP building, a Department of Water and Power building here in Los Angeles that we painted and made to look like Shake McGuire's office. And Sam Harper and I worked really hard on this dialogue couplet in which Shake says, giving up the dream. And finally we landed on the line that Steve says, which, you know, I really like, which is just going with a different one. Because that's really what the movie's about. It's, you know, you can't kind of rank dreams. You just have to pick them. And one isn't necessarily better than the other, but you figure out the kind of person you are and you pursue the one that makes sense for you.
Quitting his job? What would we have
to look at how Blake right there is staring right into the camera. Go back and watch that because it's really funny. He's literally giving the death stare into the lens. And you'll find a lot of that in the movie, not just from Blake, but all the kids, because, frankly, kids have a hard time not looking in the camera. And, I mean, I reminded them of this a million times, but it always happens. Coming up is my favorite scene in the movie. It's the stadium scene. I love the scene. It's an example of me playing music on set. I brought out huge speakers and I played this music for Steve. And he really got into it. And he came up to me afterwards and he says, I really felt something. And I said, I know, I saw. He goes, you keep playing that music. Because it as I said, it just kind of went straight to the heart of getting this performance. And the performance is amazing. Also worthy of comment is the score. Chris Beck and I worked really, really hard and long on this score because I needed it to be nothing short of gigantic emotionally. And so now I'm going to let you listen to it because he pulled it off. The way that Steve and Bonnie hold on to each other here is so moving to me because it's the way we hold on to someone who we know saves our life every day and makes us better.
I guess you could say that when Tom and I left Midland, we had a mess of theories about how to raise children. We still have a mess of children.
So that's pretty much the movie. I mean, as you can see, I'm now going to kind of riff for a while because the movie is basically over. We're in the wrap-up here. But I'm not going to let you go quite yet because as we wrap it up, there's a few things. I mean, this, by the way, look at this. These are all fake autumn leaves. Hand-placed in the bushes, hand-placed in the trees, and hand-placed on the ground because I always had this kind of archetypal image of touch football in autumn leaves. And I love that image right there. This Christmas tag is almost like a curtain call. And we did it not only because I knew going in that the movie was going to be released on Christmas Day and I wanted it to be kind of timely, but there's this moment coming up where Steve looks at his wife, looks at his family, and it's literally the look of a man taking stock and knowing that everything is right in his world. And it's a really, again, like the stadium scene, I should mention, no dialogue, no words, just performance. This was another time when I played music on set to set the tone. This is another techno crane shot up to the final tableau. But of course, the chandelier can't last because this is the Baker family. Now, these outtakes You know, they're in here for a few reasons. Number one, they're in here because I wanted to leave the audience on a kind of up comedic note. They're also in there to give you, the viewer, a small glimmer of the bedlam that went into making this movie.
Your big old family in that new apartment?
I will also mention that it's really hard to find bloopers with Steve Martin because he does not screw up very much at all. He's so prepared and he's so methodical and he's such a pro that it's hard to find these bloopers. It's very easy, however, to find bloopers like this. Shane and Brent Kinsman, as I said, they're great kids, but they'd never done a movie. Some days they didn't want to be in a movie. So every day, as you can see, I had to negotiate sentence by sentence to get this performance, and it's my way of not only amusing you but sharing my pain.
I don't want to do it anymore.
One more time.
Last one, and you're out of here.
That's a classic. We're literally, that was pea soup, by the way, so it's not like we were being cruel to the 5-year-old, but he just got really sick of pea soup on his mouth to simulate vomit, and he just, you know, when he was done, he was done. And that's where you kind of realize it brings the whole process down to earth, because it's such a big budget kind of related endeavor, and yet when you have a kid who's like, I'm done, he's done, and you have like a, you know, a multi-million dollar machine come to a halt, which is in a way frustrating, but in a better way perspective granting.
Set me on fire, they beat me, they're abusive. This is how I get jobs, right here. I'm sorry, I looked at myself in the camera.
As I leave you, I'll just kind of mention that throughout my entire career, there's always been this thing like, well, my work is soft, and kind of soft as opposed to edgy and, you know, kind of hard. And this movie, yeah, it's funny and it's soft. And it kind of hopefully connects us with fundamental principles that matter. And to the extent that it succeeds at doing that, it's work that my cast and my crew and I, for one, are proud of. So thanks for listening, and talk to you on the next one.
What wishes will